Welcome to Dr. Creepin's Dungeon. While they say that horror is hidden around every corner, just waiting for us to discover it, as we will see in tonight's 5 chilling tales of terror. Now, my dear friends, as ever, before we begin, a word of caution. Tonight's stories may contain strong language as well as descriptions of violence and horrific imagery. That sounds like your kind of thing. Then let's begin. Nearly nodding off, I sat listening to the illustrious Reverend Rob Dietz as he entered into the second hour of his sermon. My ass began to hurt from the century-old hardwood pew. I tried to shift to a more comfortable spot, but was wedged between the shoulders of 2 large old men. I looked around at the 200 members of a rural community crammed into the small church. All, including myself, had shown up to pay last respects to one Mrs. Lorraine Gilbert, a 62-year-old mother of 12 that had devoted herself to family, community, and church. A true, righteous pillar of the community. Being her youngest child, my attendance had been a forced courtesy. My stepfather decided that the funeral would be held in the community, and the church he and my mother had grown up in. So, I sat there, shoulder to shoulder with family members that still only knew me as Freddie's wife's daughter, listening to the Reverend Dietz, along with many, many others, paying homage to the much-respected, God-fearing, family-loving woman. After almost 4 hours, I felt as though they'd had plenty. As Reverend Dietz began to sing This Little Light of Mine, his 5th song, one of the old ladies in the front row with a large bun on her head and a long skirt covering her ankles, bolted upright in the standing position. Her body solidified as her fists clenched from the power of the Lord coursing through her veins. Oh, she held her hands up high. Words of unknown origin rolled off her tongue. And then she dropped to her knees and bowed her head low. Several other old ladies, with similar buns and skirts, joined her. They kneeled in front of the casket, palms pointed up. Reverend Dietz's voice rose until it shook the windows, and he began to sweat profusely, one hand raised to the heavens. I began to shift in my seat. Not being of this faith, or even being a regular churchgoer, I'd never witnessed a person going under the power. Unfortunately, my fellow attendees were very familiar with this practice, and joined the line of old ladies. Each and every one of them being struck with the love of the Lord. Soon, I was the only one in my seat. Bodies covered the floor, prostrated before the altar, singing, praying, speaking in tongues. Reverend Dietz was screaming at the top of his lungs, praising my mother for her devotion to the church and the Almighty above. He raised both hands in the air as the entire spectacle crescendoed to a fever pitch. I needed to leave, to get away from the perceived madness that had begun to unfold. If I'd had the courage to leave, well, I couldn't have done so without stepping on people. So, I sat, wild-eyed and slack-jawed. Pain emanated from the white knuckles and breaking fingernails from the grip I had on the edge of the pew. Every muscle tightened up, my heart raced, I was scared. Just when I decided that I didn't care who I had to trample on in order to get out of that damn church, my eyes fell upon the Reverend. He had stopped screaming. He stood still, hands still in the air. He looked as though he'd just been struck by lightning, his face contorted into ghastly forms. His body shuddered, his eyes rolled into the back of his head. Thinking this was part of the show, I stood up, planning my escape route. Suddenly, the Reverend dropped his hands to his sides and surveyed the congregation. He patiently waited for the power and love of God to leave his parishioners. One by one, they returned to the earthly plane, quietly got up off the floor, and returned to their seats. I sat down as well, full of confusion and fear. I mentally cursed my mother for marrying my stepfather, then cursed my stepfather for dragging me to this crazy-filled horror ride. Thinking the orgy of devotion was over, I relaxed my grip on the pew. Reverend Dietz looked across the silent church, and a smile slithered across his face. He resumed his sermon as though nothing had happened. As he spoke, his words took on an ominous tone, and a low growl began to well up from his throat. The more he spoke of the Lord, the more agitated he became. His face turned red, his mouth frothed, and sweat rolled down his forehead. He stomped over to the casket and kicked it over. "Bitch, lying, godless whore," he screamed. My mother's body flopped out of the casket as it hit the floor. The crowd gasped. Some screamed. One of the old ladies fainted, her large hairbun cushioning her head from the floor. My stepfather and my brothers raged towards the altar. "Sit down. Sit the fuck down," screamed the Reverend. His face had now contorted into what looked like an old funhouse devil mask. His teeth gnashed. He pointed a now gnarled finger at the men. In a calm tone, he repeated, "Sit the fuck down." The men stopped in their tracks. I don't know if it was fear or mind control that made them obey without questions. As they quietly returned to their seats, I was now convinced this was not part of the service and started my escape once again. Murmurs and whispering filled the room, and people started to squirm uncomfortably.
"All of you, shut your fucking mouths. Someone get that old bitch off the floor."
People sat stunned, eyes wide in terror. Some had their heads down in silent prayer. Others stared with hate and anger. Someone finally woke up the old lady who'd collapsed on the floor, helping her to a pew. Reverend Dietz stood tall at the podium.
"Now, I'm sure there is some confusion as to my behavior. Well, I'll tell you, the Lord has filled me with his power and love. He has seen fit to let me see into the hearts of each and every one of you, even the late Mrs. Gilbert. God rest her soul."
He motioned to the corpse splayed out on the floor. Reverend Dietz surveyed the crowd, making eye contact with individuals as he read their internal dialogue. When his eyes met mine, a slight look of confusion came to his eyes. He stared at me. I looked back into his soul. He continued his monologuing.
"Not one of you can call yourselves Christian. I see adulterers, thieves, rapists, and gossips. I see blackness, envy, hatred, and lust in your hearts. You are all guilty of some sin. Some guilty of all of them."
He pointed a gnarled finger at me. His eyes narrowed into slits.
You are one of the chosen. You are the only one deemed worthy. Lord be praised."
I shrunk down in embarrassment. The congregation looked at me with daggers of hate in their eyes.
"Now, Mrs. Gilbert here was not the pillar of righteousness you all claim her to be. No, Mrs. Gilbert had secrets. One was her being a prescription junkie. Just because Dr. Drug said it was okay, she was no better than addicts in the park with needles hanging out of their arms. Her beloved painkillers and sleep aids are the reason we are all here today. You all thought it was just a car crash. He looked at me directly as he said this. Whispers crept across the congregation. Reverend Dietz swept his arms through the air. She had several more secrets. 12 of them, to be exact. You see, out of all Mrs. Gilbert's children, not one of them were fathered by Mr. Hafford, her first husband. Poor Mr. Hafford. Didn't know he was shooting blanks until the day he died. Now, many another husband has had lovely Bible studies with dear, dear Mrs. Gilbert. Even after she stole Mr. Gilbert, who adopted and raised her many children, she continued to screw your husbands. More murmurs and whispers from the crowd. A sneer crossed the Reverend's face. This must be good news to you, Sister Claire. All these years, wondering if your baby boys belong to your husband or to Mr. Hafford. That's why you spread all those vicious rumors about their daughter. You didn't want your sweet boy marrying his half-sister. A few people stood up and headed for the door, not wanting their secrets to be revealed. Some kept their heads down in prayer, some in shame. I kept my eyes on the Reverend. Where do you think you're going? No one leaves, not until judgment has been passed. He scolded the congregation. He then turned his head and looked straight at me. Once again, I shrunk down in my seat, not wanting to be singled out again. He hopped down from the podium, walking through the aisles. He berated and belittled each and every parishioner until every little secret and lie was brought to light, even though their soft underbelly of deceit had been exposed. Everyone stayed quiet in their seats. Some even looked relieved to be finally outed. Many hung their heads in prayer. I was still disturbed by their lack of anger. Sheep waiting for the slaughter, I thought, when the secrets of the last lamb was revealed. He stopped at me. Why are you here? He asked. I smiled politely, eyebrow raised. To pay my respects, of course. Child, no one here deserves your respect. They all deserve to be damned to hell. He narrowed his eyes and tilted his head in acknowledgement. But you knew that already, didn't you? It doesn't matter what I know. I'm not here to judge. I'm just here for the show. I smiled, warm and sweet. Judgment is exactly what you're here for. He let out a low chuckle. I stood up and met his gaze. As I looked into his soul, I asked, "Had any good prayer sessions lately, Reverend Dietz?" Just yesterday, he said nonchalantly. She was a sweet little thing. His face contorted from devilish to confused to shame. He stammered. I've never touched a child. Never touched a child. He was aware of his confession, but unable to comprehend why the words had come out of his mouth. He began to back towards the altar. I followed. As we made our way back up to the podium, I dismissed the good Reverend with, "Thank you, Reverend Dietz. You have done your job perfectly. You may now take your seat with the rest of the lambs." The Reverend sat down in a deacon's chair, hanging his head in shame. I turned to address the congregation, Bible in one hand,
the other held out over the congregation. Channeling Charlton Heston as Moses, I spoke loudly. I instantly knew why preachers preach this way. It was fun. Ah, I guess it's time for our closing prayer. Brothers and sisters, children of God, we have gathered here to celebrate our love for the Lord and Sister Lorraine. I motioned to the corpse splayed out on the floor. Thanks to the beautiful testimony by Reverend Dietz, all of your sins have been put out to be judged, and judged they have been. Each and every one of you has been deemed unworthy in the eyes of the Lord. But in his mercy, he will pass swift and just punishment on you all. Panic started to set in. A low roar rolled through the aisles. The people dropped to their knees. Prayers rolled off the lips of every single individual. And yet, they stayed put. They never tried to leave or attack. Was it the same influence Reverend Dietz had over the angry sons? I still think it was truly a miracle how they never once confronted each other or themselves the entire time. I strolled down the podium steps and towards the main doors. Hatred, confusion, and fear filled the eyes of many as I made it to the exit. Damn sorry fools. Didn't learn a thing. As I opened the door, I turned for one last announcement. You have all lived your lives in sin. Yet, only now you pray for forgiveness. Well, your prayers have been denied. I let the door close behind me as I left. I could hear the clamor of feet and bodies, men and women screaming, trying to escape. I took a few steps into the yard, turned back towards the small church and said, Lord, I have done your bidding. The rest is up to you. I walked to my car, lit up a cigarette, and looked back at the small church. I could still hear screams and fists banging on the doors and windows. Lightning rained down from a clear blue sky, and the screams died out as the building glowed brightly. The smell of electricity and burned flesh filled the air. The news called it a tragedy full of sorrow. 218 members of a small religious community electrocuted all at once while attending a funeral for one of their most beloved and respected members. Even the corpse had been knocked over from the force. Why such a misfortune would befall a God-fearing, hard-working community was beyond comprehension. Yet no one could explain how they were fried like little white grains of rice. It was a beautiful day for a funeral, not a cloud in the sky. Lightning would never have caused so much destruction. Must have been rats chewing on the wires, or some type of conductive material used in the carpeting. I was interviewed as the sole survivor, saved only because I'd been an outsider that just couldn't bear witness to such a show of emotion, devotion, and love for the Lord. I'd been out getting some air when the tragedy took place. I was now an orphan. Without a, if you'll excuse the phrase, soul in the world. I had survivor's guilt, PTSD, grief-stricken over the loss of my entire family and adopted community. I made every major news network. Ellen, Dr. Phil, even Murray took DNA tests to find out if my father was really my father. He wasn't. I don't know how he did it, but apparently he got the DNA from every dead man in the church. My real father was Reverend Dietz. Yeah, I still chuckle at that little tidbit of information. Well, give me my Oscar right now. I played the part so well. Donations are still rolling in. Even a new car and a free ride to college. As I sit in my beautiful new house, with a very large inheritance, Being the last living member of a large family certainly has its rewards. I thank my lord. He now has 218 new souls to torment with fire and brimstone in the pits of hell. And I have received my just rewards. Horror in real life doesn't come suddenly. It's not a shock or a reactionary scream. Horror in real life is a slow realization that occurs over the course of years. It needs time to mold, decay, and spread. True horror is painful, often sad, and tragic. It's a slow deterioration, separating you from all forms of comfort and happiness. It is this kind of horror that I've felt ever since I learned of my mother's passing. The circumstances of her death did not make things any easier. It wasn't a slow death with time to make amends, adjust, or say goodbye. She hadn't been fighting a disease or infection for years. She wasn't old and nearing the end of her life. Her death came for her quickly and unexpectedly. My mother, who after divorce and my brother's moving away, had been living alone. She kept herself busy by working for the church and caring for her parents. My last couple of visits home, I'd noticed she seemed more fragile than she should for a woman of her age. She had lost weight and seemed starved for visitors. There was also a look in her eyes that bothered me. They were sleepless, panicked, and broken. It seemed as if she wanted to tell me something, but couldn't. Instead, she would just smile sadly and change the subject. I was told that my brother found her late one night in October, locked in the downstairs bathroom, naked, lying in her own blood, with her wrists sliced open. She was 63 years old. Knowing that suicide is a mortal sin in the Catholic Church, and my mother being a devout Catholic, I couldn't help but wonder if something else was involved in her passing. Not anything scandalous or plotted, but something queer and uncomfortable that had been with me and my thoughts since I was a child. It dealt with our family home and, more particularly, the old wooden doors. It all began with trouble sleeping. For as long as I can remember, I always had trouble falling asleep in my parents' house. My grandmother told me that as a small child, I was prone to sleep terrors. She would watch me during the day while my parents were at work, and in the evenings when they went out to dinner. She told me that she was watching me the night a bad storm hit our neighborhood. A tornado had been spotted that night, but never touched down. However, the lightning did claim the house's electricity. My grandmother raced to my bedroom, worried the window facing my crib would break under the violent wind. There was something else she was afraid of as well. When my grandmother picked me up from my crib, she said she felt something in the room. Something new, different, and dark. My grandmother, who came to America from Italy as a child, told my parents that she'd felt a strange presence that night, and begged them to allow her to do a prayer to remove the Maloic, an old world superstition. But my parents, who were religious, believed in angels and demons, not folklore. They didn't want to dabble in curses and superstition. As I got older, the sleep terrors continued as nightmares. It wasn't uncommon for me to wake up hours after going to bed, only to be too afraid to fall back asleep. Later, in high school, I dealt with my insomnia by not sleeping for days until I could fall asleep quickly. It wasn't until I went away for college that I was able to rest peacefully. I attribute my difficulty sleeping all of those years to the doors in my parents' house. They were big, plain wood doors, simple, with no additional furnishing or decoration. They seemed ominous, nevertheless. I would spend hours looking at the patterns in the grain, finding shapes and images in them, like one would do with clouds. The more I looked, the more I saw, until the images seemed so clear to me. Strange, famished figures, naked with one leg or half of a torso, rabid dogs, an old, bearded man. I saw faces too, wide-eyed, mouths open, sometimes made of knots in the wood, all suffering, as if the spirits of these things had somehow become trapped inside the wood. The bathroom door on the first floor was the worst. It was positioned next to the door leading to the basement, and the lock on the doorknob was finicky. It would sometimes get stuck or give way, locking or unlocking by itself. The bathroom door also had one of the strangest designs. In the center of the door, there was what looked like a woman in intense pain, as if she was in labor. Her face was contorted and blurred with vertical lines of grain, tearing its way out from what I could only imagine to be her stomach. In my childlike imagination, was a wide-eyed creature. I would see the bathroom door in my dreams as well. I had terrible nightmares, where I was floating and desperately trying to get away from the bathroom. But I was being pulled backwards by an invisible force, unable to escape. It would suck me into the darkness of the room. The door would slam shut and lock, before I would have a chance to wake up, panicked and out of breath. The nightmares and the lack of sleep only made my already active imagination worse. The strange images in the door weighed on me. There was a door for every room in the house. I could not escape them. They were a constant presence, staring out at me from the wooden veneers. As a child, I began to see other things. Things that found a way out of the trappings of the wooden frames. Not things I could look at directly, but rather things that appeared in my peripheral vision. The kinds of things that always begged to be questioned. Was someone there? Or was my imagination getting the best of me? Over time, I got better at being watchful and looking without shifting my gaze. One night when I was 6 years old, I went into my parents' bedroom feeling guilty that I wasn't yet asleep. I needed to be reassured and comforted because I'd scared myself badly. My mother gave me a hug and asked me what was wrong. I told her that I could see things out of the corners of my eyes. She asked me about their appearance, but I couldn't get a good look at them. As soon as I turned my head, they were gone. She asked me when the last time was that I'd seen one. I told her that there is one with us now, in the corner of the room. My mother looked over at what to her was an empty corner in her bedroom. She told me that maybe they were angels sent by God to watch and protect me. But they weren't. Something in the pit of my stomach would turn, and I would feel sick around them. They were motionless beings, staring blankly at me, only moving when I wasn't looking, slowly getting closer to me every time I looked away. I'd first discovered them in my peripheral vision outside my bedroom on the stairs, late at night when I couldn't sleep. I would notice a dark shape, peeking over the top stair, eyes glistening, where nothing should be. I would try to quickly shift my gaze, to refocus on them, but they were always gone. I'd eventually look away, and then find them again at my bedroom door, and then even closer, at my desk. Ever present, just out of sight. I decided that they must be demons. Not the red horn demons from cartoons, but something else. They seemed old, as if they were somehow misplaced, out of time. At night, when I'd see them, I would be too afraid to move, or do anything else but stare blankly, not giving them a chance to move in closer. Sometimes I would hear them talk to me in my head. They would tell me to do things like to wait in the corner of the room, or flood my mind with images of strange, exotic places. I would sometimes do what they said, though nothing ever came of it. My mother panicked one afternoon when she couldn't find me. She searched the entire house, eventually finding me in the bedroom closet, facing the wall, where the voices had told me to wait. She was in tears when I told her about the voices. She bought me a rosary and asked if the demons were the reason I was having trouble sleeping. Eventually, my father blessed the house with holy water, room by room, as part of the celebration of the Epiphany, recommended every year by the church. It was after this, when I was still seeing them, that my mother became bothered by my demons and their doors. It began to weigh on her as well. I grew up in a suburb just outside of Cleveland, in a working-class neighborhood predominantly made up of Irish, Italians, and Slovenians, where religion was very much a part of life. My parents were passionately involved in the church as well, and it was through them that I learned to take the sightings I was having very seriously. Instead of denouncing my demons as part of my imagination, my fears were reinforced and their existence confirmed through the power of faith and community. One night, we had a priest who was new to the parish over to our house to meet the family. After dinner, he asked me if there was anything I wanted to ask God for. I told him that there are demons in this house that hide in the doors, and I wanted them to go away. My parents shared a look of concern as my mother tried to explain. The priest looked at the doors before he left and assured me everything was okay. Later that evening, he spoke with my parents, and something was settled between these adults. A couple of months later, my father did a small home renovation, which included replacing all of the doors with white ones. It was relieving for the doors to finally be gone, and I thought I would now be rid of the strange creatures and be able to sleep. But it was too late. My mother told me that she was having the nightmares now as well. Something about the doors, she would say. As I got older, I read about the possession of objects like the Annabelle doll, and how the Native Americans believed in evil wood spirits called Wakachuna. But I mostly ignored the demons, and I eventually stopped seeing them. Despite my mother's wishes, I no longer went to church, and I refused to talk about religious matters or anything involving the strange things I'd seen and felt in the house. I told myself that the horrors I'd faced as a child were due to my overactive imagination and strict religious upbringing. By the time I left for college, there'd been no talk of doors, demons, or nightmares for a long time. Although I would still occasionally get that sick feeling in my stomach late at night, when I was near the downstairs bathroom door. My parents would later divorce, my mum keeping the house and working at the church. I moved away for work to Twin Falls. It wasn't until my dad called to tell me about the circumstances of my mother's passing that I began to wonder if something more had happened to my mother. I made the trip home to find that my childhood neighborhood had been hit hard by the recession. It was now only a faded memory of the town I grew up in. The corner ice cream parlor was now a get-cash-fast lender, and the streets were relatively empty and bleak. Houses were boarded up, and my old high school had closed. Parked at a red light, I watched the traffic light signal to empty streets. My parents' house even looked different, old and not as well kept as it had been when my father had lived there. The grass had been overrun with weeds, and the siding was dirty. We stood in front of the house that afternoon after the funeral, my brothers, father, and I. My brothers explained to me how my mum had been stressed. Her mood swings had been violent, and her sleeping pattern was erratic. She would go for long periods of time without sleeping, and then fall into a deep sleep for days. My brother told me how, late one evening after work, he'd gone over to our mother's house to check on her. It had been 2 or 3 in the morning by the time he'd arrived and let himself in, finding our mother in the kitchen making breakfast. He told me that she'd become confused about the time and had thought it was the morning. He explained that she was trying different medications to help with the insomnia, and the doctors had thought the mood swings and suicide could easily have been a side effect. I told them about how I used to have trouble sleeping in her house and about the demons and the doors. They laughed. They were too young to remember. I told them that I thought I was going to sleep better after Dad had replaced the doors. But it wasn't until college that I really slept well. That's when my dad stopped me and told me that he'd never replaced the doors. He just painted them white. Let me get this out of the way first. This really did happen to me. This is 100% true story, especially the part where I uppercutted a ghost through heaven itself. As with most true stories, do not expect some great shocking ending. I can only relate to you what I know. This is a mystery to me and probably will remain so for the rest of my life. I'm only telling you this because I feel like it highlights a concept I want to discuss. If you're willing to accept that fact, then let me tell you what happened to me one night when I was home alone. It was back when I lived in Kalamazoo, Michigan. I no longer live in Michigan, so I have no qualms with stating that little fact. I was a teenager at the time. My sister was in college and my parents were taking my brother out to look at colleges in the Midwest. I want to say I was 14 or 15 at the time. It was the summer and I'd been at football camp. I told my parents that I would be there for a week rather than the actual 5 days, so I could be home alone for a few days. Looking back, I realized if I told them the truth, they wouldn't have been all that concerned. But I guess I just wanted the excitement of pulling one over on them. I did manage to get some excitement out of it all, but not in the way I'd hoped. I got home and set about doing what teenagers want to do. I blasted heavy metal, climbed out of my window onto my roof to smoke cigarettes, and other illicit things that are best left unsaid. I enjoyed the freedom and took advantage of the opportunity to watch some horror movies. They weren't really all that scary, but I do think they set up a certain atmosphere. I even ordered a pizza to eat while I watched my marathon. I must have forgotten to close the door when I paid for the pizza, because when I was getting ready for bed, I found the front door to my house wide open. I don't mean open by a crack. I mean completely open for anyone and everyone to walk in uninvited. I would have normally thought nothing of it, of course, but I was alone, and I just watched 4 horror movies back to back like a genius. I had visions in my head of a crazed vagrant hiding in a closet with a box cutter waiting for me to fall asleep before carving his murderous manifesto into my chest. I decided to arm myself with what I had on hand, a BB gun we used to spook off squirrels and raccoons, Yeah, we lived in a rural area. It was made to look like a handgun, and was so realistic that it would probably get you shot if you started waving it around in public. You even loaded the BB gun by pulling back the slide, which gave it a very similar appearance to a real handgun. I hope that any razorblade-wielding base heads could be intimidated with this imitation. I'd hope that they wouldn't call my bluff, because I had a crystal-clear mental image of a BB bouncing ineffectually off his chest before he vivisected me with a chainsaw. I proceeded to sweep my house, looking in every closet and under every bed. I even checked the attic. Each time, the tension within me grew tighter and tighter in my chest, like I would pull open a door to see a man with a knife-sliced smile and butcher's knife grinning at me. I had the pants-shittingly terrifying mental image that he was slowly stalking behind me and hiding in the places I'd already searched, biding his time and sharpening his Freddy Krueger-style knife gloves in anticipation. I swept the house once, twice, 3 times without any sign of an intruder. I put the BB gun back and went to bed. I undressed down to my boxers and hopped in my bed. I don't remember at what time I drifted off exactly, but I do remember what time I was woken up. It was 2:30 in the morning, because I remember thinking to myself, who the hell is making that noise this late at night? It took a few seconds for my sleep-addled brain to register that I was home alone, and another few seconds to place the sound. It sounded like something was tapping on my window. I was facing away from the window and had that childish thought that I should just ignore it and it would go away. It was the thought that the sound might not be coming from outside into my room, but from inside my room itself, that made me roll over and look around my room. There was no recently escaped convict in my room, gazing at my sleeping form with some sort of murder erection. That was a good start. The tapping was still going on throughout all of this, though. It was definitely coming from the vicinity of my bedroom window. Just for shits and giggles, tap on a nearby window or glass surface. Using that as a frame of reference, imagine hearing that sound coming from your bedroom window late at night. Now imagine remembering that you lived on the second floor of a house. The nearest tree was 15 feet away and out of range for its branches to be smacking against the window. My mind painted images of hockey mask-wearing men sitting on the 3-foot space of the roof outside my room, tapping on my window with their machetes. I slept with the blinds down to prevent the sun from waking me up too early, so I couldn't just simply look out my window. I would have to get out of my bed and open the blinds. I was genuinely terrified that someone was outside my window. I got out of bed as quietly as I could. I thought any sound would incite my brutal death. I crept towards my closet and opened the door. I was no longer imagining home invaders waiting in the dark closet with their sickles sharpened. I was certain that there was a clear and present danger feet away from me, outside my window. I searched my closet for something to defend myself. The only thing I could find was a wiffle bat. I almost laughed at the absurdity of me tearing open the blinds, threateningly wielding a plastic bat at the intruder. At least they would have some decent comedic fodder for my tombstone. He died in his boxers, brandishing a plastic bat against a sword-swinging undead samurai. I found nothing else even remotely feasible for a weapon. I crept over to the window with a plastic bat in my fist. The tapping was still emanating from the window. I cautiously raised my hand to pull the string. I hesitated for a full minute in paralyzing fear. I reasoned that I could try to peek out at whatever was still making the noise. I was debilitated by the prospect of peeking out, only to see an eye staring back at me. I'd been standing before the window for fully 10 minutes now. The prospect that as soon as I opened the blinds, I could incite my violent and bloody death gave me considerable pause. I had, and have, so many dreams and goals that I didn't want to be interrupted by whoever was toying with me outside. I managed to pump myself up enough to grab the pull string. I listened to the inconsistent but continual noise coming from inches away. I decided to open it on the 10th tapping sound. The noise stopped. The lack of noise was so much worse than the incessant tapping. The silence seemed to be pregnant with malicious intent. Were they planning to blitz me now? Was their game over? Would they come crashing into my bedroom through the window? I held on to the plastic bat so tightly that my cuticles went white. I decided that it was now or never. I grabbed the drawstring for the blinds and pulled. And nothing. There was nothing outside. Had they fled? Had they tired of the mind games and moved on to more responsive targets? The sudden thought that they had dropped down to the lawn and were entering the house made me go to my bedroom door and lock it. My back was to the window, and my hand had just touched the door lock when... the sound was back. I whirled around, and my heart was hammering in my chest. There was nothing outside. I remembered thinking that this must be what insanity felt like. The sound was coming from the window, but there was nothing outside. I got close to the window and listened for the sound. My mind raced, trying to attribute the sound to something. I couldn't explain it. There was absolutely no reasonable explanation. But the tapping continued. I must have examined every inch of the window and the area around it to discover the source of the sound, but I had no luck. The sound stopped after a few minutes, and I decided that I was too tired to try and piece it all together. I lay back in my bed. I closed my eyes and tried to sleep. But just as I was drifting off, I didn't sleep at all for the rest of the night. I half expected the sound to come back the next night, but there was nothing. I don't know what would be worse. If the noise came back, or if it vanished without any explanation. If it started up, I could reason it was the house, settling on the wood, shifting and expanding in the cool summer night air. It didn't return, and my mind is still unable to think of what had caused that sound. Was it some fiendish monster toying with my mind? Was it the spirit of the least threatening ghost possible? My parents came home the day after that, and I lived in that house for a few years before I went to college, and my parents moved to another state. In that time, I never heard that tapping sound again. It's almost weird how clearly I can remember all of this. I guess it's because this memory had such a profound impact on me. It helped me realize that sometimes the scariest thing in life isn't a corporeal thing. The scariest thing is a mystery, an unexplainable occurrence. The scariest thing is something incomprehensible to the human mind. Even if it is something as minuscule as the sound of tapping on your window late at night. My eyes are in a fervorous affair with the clock, and my focus is none the wiser. The police dispatcher is pleading for me to humor her inquiries, if for no reason other than to keep my consciousness afloat. It is so late, and today has been so challenging. Nevertheless, I'll gratify her with my story, because I'm really in no mood to tell it again later. Mariam Cliffington happened into our photo center again today. These visits are becoming relentless, as are the innumerable poorly photoshopped images on her SanDisk flash drive. Every day, it's the same process. She perches at our photo kiosk, orders small batches of 5x7 and 4x6 photos, and crones over the photo printer as it squeals its mechanical protests. The unfortunate photo specialist on duty is then scolded by dear old Mariam as the color in my son's face is coming out too pale, and my granddaughter's dress looks smudged, too washed out, becomes as recitable as the Lord's Prayer. The project is then gifted to me, as I am the only one who receives her limited mercy. This is due in part because I'm the only one in the store qualified as a professional photo editor. I also look just like her son. At least, that's what she tells me every time she swoons over the photos I correct. I personally never saw the extreme resemblance. We have similar Hollywood-esque hairstyles. Dark stubble, light eyes, and a fair complexion. But that's where the similarities end. Well, that's my general assumption. Truthfully, I have never met him. According to Mariam, they don't get along so well these days. Reportedly, her son has become what she calls a changed person after he split with his wife. That always seemed odd to me, because nearly every day, I'm draining the red out of a new family photo that she zealously adds in her novice Photoshop sessions. It seems the family often stays in touch. Today, we discuss more personal topics, such as my college degree and her family get-togethers. She told me she was celebrating her granddaughter Gracie's 5th birthday today, and was putting together a photo album and baked goodies to send her. Today's photos were of the girl from her previous birthday. She had straw blonde hair, her father's bright blue eyes, rosy red cheeks, and a devilish grin that strongly reminded me of the girl from the movie Problem Child 2. When the topic turned to me being a graduate in multimedia design, she immediately began to give me the shakedown on my talents as a web developer. She wanted me to build a forum-based website just for her family. She wasn't fond of the public limelight social media granted, but wanted regular updates from her son, granddaughter, their prized show horses, and images from all the reunions they've had over the years. I'm not a fan of Mariam. She may treat me in a more humane manner than my colleagues, but she's always so bitter. She carries an air of importance about her that mismatches with who she is, like a pug in a sweater made of silk, The last thing I want from a client is a beady pair of eyes reflected behind ancient, dark-rimmed tortoiseshell glasses, critiquing my every line of code with ignorant words laced with the smell of stale coffee and menthol cigarettes. Her grey-black hair is often wild and tangled, as if she was fleeing her home every morning to develop photos which contain the cure for cancer. Despite her lack of self-management, she saw herself as an expert in managing the talents of others. I inquired about the specifics of her family problems, but I assumed this attitude must cause the bulk of it. The sense of entitlement is something I don't blend well with. After endless barrages of questions about my rates, schedule, and ability to tutor her in Photoshop, I gave her my business card and told her to call me in a few weeks. Truthfully, I'm in my 2-week leave period and on my way to a better job, and this was a simple method to evade her until I would never have to see her again. She seemed content with my proposal and took my card. I told her to forward my congratulations to her granddaughter on a 5-year milestone. As she shuffled out of our store, I looked again at the refuse pile of discolored prints. If her family is so dysfunctional, why does she bring in new pictures of her son and granddaughter every other day? Why, as a spitting image of the son she frequently quarrels with, am I so reasonably treated by her? Those suspicions came to fruition a few hours later when a 20-something couple dropped off a few rolls of 35mm film. They had matching black hair, the athletic builds of bicyclists, and eyes that reflected deep kindness, but an even deeper sense of fatigue. The lab's business was running slow today, so I was immediately able to process their order and begin development. The development process is always the same. I feed just enough of the raw film through a machine to attach it to a leader card, which is mechanically guided through the film processor. After it completes its voyage and the developed film is fed through, I place it on the scanner of our printing machine and check the frames digitally for color flaws and inconsistencies. The picture showed the young couple celebrating another birthday. A boisterous banner which read, "Happy Birthday, Mitch," hung above an electric blue neon minibar. The couple was shown holding beer bottles and laughing heartily. The entire set was quite like photos most young couples bring in. There was a sloppy drunken kiss here, someone air guitaring on a table there. I began to complacently press the print button after every 6 frames. Then, I noticed a picture of Mariam's son. Even though I'd never met him, I had seen that face often. It was a face that was branded into the back of my eyes like the bright red digits of a digital alarm clock in the first few moments of morning consciousness. I was intrigued that these two may also be familiar with the eccentric woman who both frowned upon and adored her family. As I was packing up their photos and ringing up their orders, I decided to make conversation. "So, you know Mariam Cliffington?" I asked casually. Silence. I glanced upward, and the glance became a fixture. A paleness and shock had matched the exhaustion they both wore in their eyes. "Are you okay? I recognized her son in your photos." The girl spoke, tears welling in her eyes. "That's our friend Mitch. Those photos were taken a few weeks ago. He passed last week. This order is for his funeral slideshow." Her boyfriend spoke next, clearly unsettled but retaining his composure, as he quickly recited what I am sure he's gotten used to explaining. "He and his daughter were found dead in Mariam's home last Sunday, poisoned. The police have been seeking her for questioning. Have you seen her recently?" I was floored. I'm rarely one to lose my cool, but I began tripping over my words like they were raised on a high wire. Yes, she was in here a few hours ago. She said she was celebrating Gracie's 5th birthday. She's working on a new photo album. They were new photos. The girl spoke next. We need to call the police immediately. Gracie's birthday was the Tuesday before they were found. They didn't enjoy visits with Mariam, but she insisted on being with them to celebrate. Call them, I did. I spent the rest of my shift plus 2 extra hours conversing with a police detective and the couple. He asked me to print out the information we had on Mariam, and if we had any idea of her whereabouts. They inquired about the frequency of her visits, the types of purchases she made from the rest of the store, her current appearance, and general abnormalities in her behavior. I gave them what they needed, along with surveillance footage from the cameras we'd hidden around the building. They gave me the direct line to their office and sent me off with my assurance that I would call them immediately if Mariam came into the shop again. The drive home felt relatively non-existent. The thoughts of what had occurred seemed to dominate my sense of time while on the road. Had this lady, who compared me to her own son, been responsible for his death, for the death of his daughter? Would I see her before the police? I arrived at my house in the same psychological state as when I'd left the store. I nearly broke my ankle while stumbling over a package that was placed in front of the entryway. I brought it inside into the light and saw that the sender's name was Mom. I wasn't sure what the occasion was, but I assumed it was a late Thanksgiving care package. Regardless, it was good to receive mail from her. I wasn't sure where her new apartment was. Now I had her address, 6312 Prospect Road. Inside the package was a tin box of cookies and a neatly wrapped rectangular gift. I hadn't gotten to eat lunch with all of the police activity, so I immediately started tanking through the cookies as if I'd also skipped my last 5 meals. After my 4th cookie, I decided to wipe the crumbs from my hands and see what the mystery gift was. I unceremoniously ripped the red and gold metallic paper off of what appeared to be a small photo album bound in black vinyl. I opened it with giddy curiosity and felt the blood empty from my face. It was a timeline of photos from Marion Cliffington's family. These weren't the fun family get-togethers I'd recrafted at the photo lab. I hadn't printed these at all. Page 1. Mitch and Gracie are propped against the arm of a tan leather sofa. Daughter wrapped in father's arms. Their eyes are sunken and rolled backwards, and their tongues are lolled out of their mouths in an unnatural brown color. There is dried spittle and yellow foam caught in Mitch's black stubble, and a mixture of blood and vomit on the front of Gracie's shirt. The blood vessels in their faces are a sickly blue, and their skin is pale and puffy. This photo is labeled, Tuesday. Happy birthday, Gracie. Page 2. The bodies are placed in a maroon 2013 Toyota RAV4. They've been cleaned up and posed. Mitch in the front seat, Gracie in the center back seat. Their skin has continued to swell as their eyes are puffy slits. Their now purple lips have been sewn shut and side-stitched into makeshift smiles. One of Mitch's arms is placed on the wheel, the other propped against the passenger seat in a pathetic wave. The label, Wednesday, taking Gracie to school. Page 3. The bodies are now dressed in swimsuits and are posed around a kiddie pool. Mitch had to be propped up in an unknown manner that is clearly hidden from the frame. He's on his knees at the edge of the pool in blue and white Hawaiian shorts. Gracie is in the pool, positioned on her belly in a striped pink one-piece bathing suit with a matching swim skirt. Their hands are duct taped together, and their skin has taken on a sickly yellow color. They are starting to bruise and darken in areas in which they'd evidently been placed for too long. The label, Thursday, teaching Gracie to swim. Page 4. Mitch is now dressed in a handsome ivory tuxedo, which has a few off-color stains, where his skin is starting to split open. He's at his kitchen table with a full glass of white wine and a lit dining candle in front of him. The sleeves on his arms reveal dark bruising, where the tape was wrapped with his daughter's arms the day before. Gracie is not in this picture, but Mariam is. She is grasping one of his rotting hands in one of her own, with a brimming glass of red wine in the other. She wears a motherly smile that sickeningly matches the sewn-on smile of her lifeless son. The label, Friday, Dinner with the Boy. Page 5. Gracie is propped against the wall, the skin of her arms ripped off where the tape was 2 days prior. Her face is beginning to lose its humanity, but is now coated in makeup worthy of a Little Miss Sunshine pageant. Her straw blonde hair is curled and bouncy, and her artificial smile is beginning to tear along the stitching. Next to her is an assortment of porcelain dolls, each made up and dressed with care, that is a bit too sophisticated for a 5-year-old girl. To the far left of the frame, Mariam's reflection could be seen in a full body mirror, pointing the camera at the twisted salon she constructed. The label, Saturday, Girls Night Out. Page 6. There is finally a full frame of the house in which this sickening family montage was photographed. It is a modest one-story home on the foothills of the Rocky Mountains. The paint is a simple white, and it is beginning to flake from a simple picket fence that marked the perimeter. There are no other homes close by that are visible from the angle of the shot. In the left of the frame, the stables of the prized horses Mariam mentioned are visible in the background. The gates are wide open, and the horses are nowhere to be seen. Police cars, ambulances, and yellow crime scene tape blocks the rest of the view, except for the mailbox. The address on the mailbox? 6312 Prospect Road. The size of the frame indicate motion blur and plastic paneling. Mariam photographed this from a moving vehicle, likely from far away. The label reads, Sunday, the family gets to see policemen in action on career day. On the final page, Mariam is standing in front of my house with the package I'd just opened. The label, Thursday. Dropping off goodies for my favorite son. In that moment of realization, weakness took control of my body. Not just from the imagery I was subjected to, but from a sickening feeling that burned in my stomach and intestines. Words from earlier were ripping through my skull. You look just like my son. He and his daughter were found dead in Mariam's home last Friday. Poisoned. I forced myself to scan the backgrounds of those horrible pictures. On the first page, in Gracie's lap, was the cookie tin I'd just eaten from. This package was not from my mother. It was from a crazed mother who thought I was her son, guided to my home from the business card I'd given her. Now, here we are. I don't think I have much time left. I'm starting to lose focus. My eyes are in a fervorous affair with the clock, and my focus is none the wiser. Maybe they'll get married and elope. I'll invite this dispatcher to the wedding if I make it through this. I vaguely realize that doesn't make sense, but I don't mind. I'm so tired, and now I can't stop coughing. I think I hear sirens in the distance, but I'm not sure if the ambulance has a cure for vomiting blood. Someone is coming up the stairs. I have to go now. Mariam is here, and she wants to give Gracie swimming lessons. Ellie's eyes fluttered open, only to be blasted by strong white light. Her arm shot up and hid her face from the glare as she slowly became able to see her surroundings. She was stuck in a plexiglass cube, big enough for her 13-year-old self to stretch out her arms and barely be able to lay down both palms of her hands on opposite walls. The material was transparent, and through it, Ellie could clearly see that her cube cage was somehow stuck to the center of a square wall, about 5 feet off the ground. The room was a brilliant white color. Marble tiles decorated the floors, and a very strong light was coming from a simple white luminaire hanging from the center of the ceiling. It was shaped rectangularly, as the wall opposite to the one Ellie's box was mounted on was much further than the ones to the side. That wall had a white door with a silver knob in the center. There was a desk at the half point between her box and the door, offset towards the wall on Ellie's right-hand side, though she couldn't see a chair behind it. A black fountain pen with a golden nib resting on a black, round holder, and a white clipboard with blank papers were the only things on the table, which seemed to be made of white, glossy plastic. Next to the table, and below the light hanging from above, stood a person. He was tall enough to meet Ellie's eyes without her looking down. The slenderness of his body was emphasized by the black buttons, creating a dotted line from his neck to his white pants and plain black shoes. His face, as if floating in the whiteness, was framed by a curled cloud of thick black hair. His most striking feature were his blood-red eyes, staring motionlessly, unblinkingly at Ellie. The man's face was expressionless. Ellie, startled, knocked on the translucent wall, trying to get the man's attention, but to no avail. She felt the claws of fear and panic slowly climbing up her stomach, weaving spiderwebs in her chest, making it hard to breathe. Her fear rose like the mercury in a thermometer sunken into hot water. She heard a metallic humming noise of something running through pipes from behind her, followed by a splash. She quickly veered her head around to find the source. Water was pouring onto the floor, the pressure making the glass-looking jet come down just shy of the center of the bottom panel. It soaked into her skirt and got into her shoes before she could get up on her knees. Her face was now in the tight grip of terror as she slammed her palms against the window, desperately screaming for help. The man stood, unmoved. The transparent liquid pooled about a centimeter deep at the bottom of the cube, and it looked as if it was the bottom panel expanding upwards. Ellie had given up on the staring man and looked for a way out. She shoved at the top panel with all her might, then pressed her back against one side and pushed at the other with her feet. It didn't budge. The cube was over a quarter full by now, the water level well above Ellie's waist. The little girl's clothes were soaked now, clinging to her body. She reassumed her position on her knees, once more pleading with the motionless man. Her cries became high-pitched as the cold fluid slowly crawled its way up her thighs, unsticking the bottom of her skirt from her body, making it float. Tears viciously poured down her cheeks as her cries for help turned to sobs. Soon, she was on her feet, her palms pressed against the top window, the liquid up to her neck. Her silent crying occasionally turned to loud wails of mixed horror and anger, but subsided whenever her chin touched the liquid, and the paralyzing fear of drowning repossessed her body. As the last 2 centimeters of the cube were filled, Ellie took one last deep breath and went under. She looked through the front panel, but could barely see 2 black specks. One was the penholder on the table. The other was the man's hair. She hid the glass again, a few precious air bubbles escaping her lips. Her chest began to hurt from holding in the air. She placed her hands over her lips, desperately trying to keep the air in. Her palms slowly moved to her throat. She couldn't take it anymore. The need to exhale was like a hot iron stuck in her head. Exhale. The air had to be pushed out. Ellie hit the glass. A bouquet of bubbles erupted from Ellie's mouth. The silver flowers of her last breath floated to the top of the cube and were slowly sucked out by unseen tubes. Ellie took a breath of the fluid and immediately started to cough it out. A few more sparkles escaping her lips. And then her world faded to black. The black-haired man stood and watched as her lifeless body floated in the liquid. Her hair fanned out like a curtain, crowning her head with the dark chestnut color. She looked as if she was caught in a giant ice cube that had very sharp edges. Her face wasn't contorted with pain nor screaming anymore. It was peaceful now. Ellie's eyes shot open, her entire body flinching. She was lying in the soft embrace of a bed, the covers pulled up to her neck. It was so delightfully dry and warm that even in her panic state, she was able to appreciate the comfort it offered. Just then, a figure leaned over and into view, causing Ellie to let out a frightened gasp. It was the man. The one who'd watched her drown. Except... Hello, Ellie. His blue eyes sparkled with a calm kindness. Where am I? She asked, trembling with fear. Even if he did hear the question, his features didn't show it. Am I dead? Ellie stuttered on. At this, the man's clean-shaven face softened into a smile. Oh, she said, looking somewhat disappointed, and only slightly less weary. She eyed the man very carefully. Are you God? The man's smile remained motionless. Ellie took it as a yes, but investigated further. But... you look just like that terrible person who... Well, I told him to help me, but he just stood there and then there was all this water and then I think I drowned. Oh? Asked the man, with a voice which was perhaps a bit too smooth. She'd always imagined God as having an angry, roaring voice, like the one her mother imitated whenever she read Bible stories to Ellie before bed. The story about Moses, at least her mother's rendition of it, was her favorite. Yes. His eyes were different, but you look just like him. The man answered, his eyes now focusing on Ellie's. What?
I always look like the last person you saw during your life. Did you not like the person who looks like me?
In spite of everything, Ellie was nearly convinced. She remembered how she drowned in that see-through cell, after all.
Can you prove it? Can you prove you're God?
The man then curiously raised his eyebrows, and then went back to smiling. He motioned for Ellie to sit up. She did so, and now was able to see around the room. She was lying in a four-poster queen bed, with white wood posts. The sheets were white, with detailed floral designs. The carpet was white, and so was a chest of drawers up against the wall across from Ellie. There was an open window to the left, and white silken curtains were swaying gently in the wind. Beyond it, Ellie only saw bright light. There were no doors anywhere in the room. The man was sitting next to her on the bed. His arm was now outstretched, fingers limply pointing at the chest of drawers. The palm of his hand slowly rose, and with it, the piece of furniture. It stopped 3 feet off the ground, before he gently set it down again. Ellie tried to stifle a whoa, but failed, feeling like a little kid for doing so. She fell into silence, her mind trying to comprehend everything that had happened.
So this is heaven, then?
She finally asked.
Not quite, answered the blue-eyed man. We'll talk about that a little later, though. Now, we should talk about you.
The two spun a long thread of conversation, and Ellie told him all about her life. They talked about her family. Ellie loved her parents and her brother dearly. She admired her father for being so knowledgeable, but also confessed that she was sad whenever he was too engrossed in his work to listen to her. They talked about school. Ellie did pretty well academically, but she felt quite at odds with most of the other girls. She didn't give much thought to the boys, unless they purposefully nagged her. Even then, she would usually ignore them, and they would give up eventually. Ellie had few friends. Throughout her schooling, she'd always stuck around one person most of the time, though that person changed every 2 years or so. She would still maintain good relationships with most of the girls that had been her friends like that, but not all of them. They talked about Aisha, her best friend at the time. She and Ellie shared what they thought was a unique craziness, which would only come out when they were at home, one visiting the other. They would put up shows to an imaginary audience, which would, invariably, end with both of them rolling on the floor with laughter, barely breathing. Aisha had that one music band that she'd always listened to. Ellie noted that she was slowly warming up to them, having already learned two of the songs by heart. Aisha lived on the internet, her mobile phone constantly chirping with notifications whenever the two of them were together. They would often read through them and answer strangers on the net, giggling at how witty their responses must have been. They talked about books, which Ellie thought was kind of funny. She'd read a lot of books up to the age of 10 or so, but then sort of stopped. It had fallen out of fashion, and though she'd always advocate books, she wouldn't really read them all that much as of late. She'd just finished explaining that, although she liked romance, fantasy was her favorite genre, when the man interrupted her by saying, "Excuse me, Ellie, but are you hungry by any chance?" Ellie's stomach had been rumbling for a while now, but she hadn't noticed as she'd been immersed in the conversation.
"Yes,"
she simply answered, hiding her embarrassment.
"Good. How does apple pie sound?"
the man said in a soft tone.
"That's my favorite,"
Ellie said, momentarily touched. How did you know? The man simply smiled in response, opened the bedside cupboard and pulled out a hot pan of apple pie, a plate, and some utensils. He cut out a piece and handed it to her on the plate, watching her as she hungrily devoured the delicious treat. Oh, excuse me, would you also like some? She asked, halfway through her piece, her eyes practically begging him to say no. That's very kind of you, but I'm quite all right, said the man, still smiling. He patted her head and sat back down on the side of the bed. Quite some time had passed since Ellie had awoken. Ellie, may I ask you another question?
Yes,
answered Ellie, her mouth full, a crumb of pie rolling out and somewhere between the sheets. Her eyes frantically searched for it on the bed around her, and when they found nothing, she turned back to the man, trying to look as inconspicuous as possible. Before I take you to heaven, I can give you another shot at life, if you'd like. Ellie cocked her head to the side, expecting an explanation. If you go to heaven with me, you won't see Mommy, Daddy, your little brother, or Aisha for a very long time. But if you go back, you might see them again. You might live out your life, and the next time we meet could look different. I might look like your future husband, or one of your children, if you have either of those. Each of the words nudged at Ellie, making rips in her current peaceful mood. She wanted to see her parents. She was pretty sure she would have liked to have lived a longer life. Her eyes welled up. Can you do it? She asked in a strangled voice. That smile. Again. Please, do it then, she said, her head sinking. The blue-eyed man pulled a small silver box from his pocket. He opened it and got out a syringe of clear liquid. He flicked it gently, then squirted some out of the needle. He started lowering himself towards Ellie. This will help you calm down. Then you'll wake up back in the real world. He squeezed the contents into her arm. Ellie started to feel dizzy almost immediately. He set the syringe down on the cupboard and gently held Ellie's hand until her world went dark again. James Knight got up from the bed, only taking a second to admire his handiwork. His hand slipped into his pocket, pulling out another box. This one smaller and grey in colour. He took out a red contact lens and gently placed it into his left eye. Then he did the same for his right eye. Then he produced a tissue from the same pocket and wiped the small droplet of blood that had gathered on Ellie's arm where he'd injected her. The red-eyed man gathered the girl in his arms and carried her down to the office. He jumped up on a stepladder and gently placed Ellie into the clear glass cube, which was again empty of the liquid, its top side opened like a lid. He closed the lid and locked it into place by pressing it down. Then he carried the stepladder out of the room, came back in, and closed the door behind him. James watched, completely still, as Ellie woke up. He watched Ellie scream and beg for his help. He watched the absolute horror in her eyes when the perfluorodecalin again began to pour into the box. It wasn't water pouring in, but rather a breathable liquid. It wouldn't really drown her, since she could still breathe while submerged. But Ellie didn't know that. Ellie couldn't have known that. And so, he watched, yet again without expression, as her air ran out, and Ellie drowned again. And so once again, we reach the end of tonight's podcast. My thanks as always to the authors of those wonderful stories, and to you for taking the time to listen. Now, I'd ask one small favor of you. Wherever you get your podcast from, please write a few nice words and leave a 5-star review, as it really helps the podcast. That's it for this week, but I'll be back again same time, same place, and I do so hope you'll join me once more. Until next time, sweet dreams and bye-bye.